Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam. Dear listeners, Radio Sai continues its weekly presentation of the talking book version of Mr. Howard Moffat's highly acclaimed book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The author was among the very early Westerners who came to Satya Sai Baba as a skeptic in 1964, and drawn by his enigma, he stayed for considerable periods of time near him in the next 6 years. During this period, he conducted extensive research and probing investigations into the Sai phenomena. He published his findings as the book that has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer which introduced Sri Satya Sai Baba to millions round the world. This book was first published in 1971. Since then, it has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the loving path of Satya Sai. These readings, dear listeners, are being aired every week, and if you wish to revisit a chapter at any time, you can do so at our website radiosai.org. So dear listeners, welcome now to Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Moffat.
Sai Ram, and welcome to Radio Sai's Talking Book Session. This is a presentation of select excerpts from Mr. Howard Moffat's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. We are now at Chapter 10, entitled, A Place Apart. At the outset, the author quotes William Shakespeare from King Richard II. Quote, "All places that the eye of heaven visits are, to a wise man, ports and happy havens," unquote. By now, we heard how the author, Mr. Moffat, and his wife, Iris, were blessed with many close encounters with Sri Satya Sai Baba. On one such occasion, he even invited Howard to join him on his trip to Madras. Today, Mr. Moffat recollects of his joyous trip with Bhagwan.
"After breakfast, we drove off, Raja at the wheel, two other males, Baba and myself. A few miles from Whitefield, we stopped at a service station for petrol, and before the tank could be filled, a crowd had gathered around the car. Among them was a beggar woman to whom Swami gave money. I have never seen him pass a beggar without giving alms. Even if one of them is beside the road in the country, when the car is speeding along, Baba stops and passes out some practical expression of his sympathy and love to the unfortunate person. Today, Baba was evidently in the mood to entertain the youth with some magic. Taking a green betel leaf, he cut from it with his thumbnail a small round disc, which he marked with a symbol. Passing me the circle of leaf, he asked what the symbol was. It might have been a Sanskrit mantram, but I really had no idea. Without enlightening me, he took it back and placed it on the youth's palm, still holding it by his own fingertips. When he took his fingers away, the disc of green leaf had vanished, and in the boy's palm lay another disc of about the same size, but this one had an enamel front, which bore a picture of the head of Vishnu. When I was given it to examine closely, I observed with interest that it was a green portrait on a white background, and the green was of exactly the same shade as the leaf had been. It was actually a pendant with a loop for attachment. Turning it over, I noted that there was a slight flaw in the metal backing. Whether it was because of the flaw or some other reason, I do not know, but Baba held the pendant again in the boy's palm, leaving there, this time, a similar sized one bearing the triple heads of the Hindu Trinity, Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. The color of the second pendant was different, and there was no flaw in the metal backing. The youth was allowed to keep this one, while the first simply disappeared from Baba's fingers."
However, on this whole trip, Mr. Murfitt sets aside two of his observations as most significant. Let us listen to what they are.
Looking back on my brief but marvelous time in Madras with Sai Baba on this visit, two things project from the wealth of impressions. One is the mysterious way in which his presence became known to the public. We arrived for a late lunch, had a short siesta, and then I took a look from an upstairs window of the Venkatamuni house where we were staying. The front garden was already nearly filled with people, hundreds sitting cross-legged on the ground waiting for a sight of the great man. No public announcement had been made, no publicity whatever had been given. In fact, our hosts themselves knew only a couple of hours before we arrived that we were coming, and they had merely phoned a few close devotees to whom Swami wanted to talk for one reason or another. This handful would probably tell a few friends who were also close disciples. But devotees are always careful not to publicize the news that Sai Baba is coming. The crowd swarms swiftly enough without such encouragement, and Swami seems to like a quiet beginning for his visits so that he can talk to the families who have loved him long and faithfully. Yet some telepathic whisper had gone through the city, and by evening the front and side gardens were packed with people patiently awaiting the appearance of the beloved figure.
Having concluded that the mysterious force of Bhagwan's love spreads like wildfire, making his presence known to thousands of eager hearts in a few quick moments, Mr. Murfitt observed another feature consistent with Baba's loving nature.
The other thing that I was able to appreciate more than ever before was Baba's superhuman energy. From mid-afternoon until late into the night, he was interviewing people singly or in groups, moving among the large crowds, or going out to visit the homes of devotees who were either sick or needed him to come to them for some reason. The same constant activity went on the whole of the next day until about 7 in the evening when we left for Whitefield. A few miles out of Madras, waiting by the roadside, was a carload of some of his most devoted followers who wanted one more sight of him, one more word, one more blessing from his hand. This he granted, and their eyes moistened with tears of love. And then we went off on our 5-hour journey through the darkness, through the villages, through the straying buffaloes and nonchalant cows that infest the roads of India. We reached Vrindavanam after midnight to find a group of visitors there waiting to see Baba even at that hour. On subsequent tours, I saw this same pattern of daily programs with the addition of bhajan sessions, public addresses, and other big functions. We, his companions on the tour, would be permitted to drop out from time to time to take a few hours rest while Swami carried on. Or we would merely sit quietly in the car while he went into the homes of devotees, spending some time with them, bringing them joy, hope, and spiritual food. From morning till night, and usually to midnight or later, Baba is on the go, devoting himself to the needs and welfare of those who come to him or beg him to come to them, verbally or by the telepathy of prayer. He does the work of many ordinary human beings, yet I have never seen him really exhausted. Sometimes he may look a trifle tired, but he rapidly recovers full vigor. It is as if he drinks at the fountainhead of all energy. Once when I asked Swami if he would do something for me, he answered, "Yes, of course. I am your property. I have no rights."
Indeed, Swami's life has been only a continual sacrifice and service to all his devotees, and through them, to all of mankind. Just as when the divine pebble of love is thrown into the pond of human ignorance and sorrow, the waves circle outward until they reach the very edge. But this was not all. Swami again invited the couple to travel with him in his car to Puttaparthi.
Only my wife, Raja, was driving, and I were with Swami on this occasion. It was Iris's first visit to the ashram, and along the route, Baba pointed out various landmarks to her. He also gave her practice in a Hindi sacred song he was teaching her. but most of the time he was wrapped in serene silence. As we entered Prashanthi Nilayam, my heart leapt to see all the residents, hundreds of them lined up along the way, so that we drove through an avenue of smiling, joyous faces. Later, the crowd gathers around the circular garden in front of the main building for their first visual contact with Baba as he comes onto the balcony to raise his hand in benediction. This is the day's first darshan, blessing by appearance. Soon after this, interviews begin. Taking groups of anything from a dozen to 20, he spends perhaps half an hour, sometimes an hour or more, with each group. In this way, he manages to make close contact with on average about 150 people a day, more in busy periods. Later in the morning, there is an hour's bhajan. Baba often comes and sits on his high chair in the hall for part of this. During part of it, he might walk among the people seated outside under the trees. Sometimes he spends most of the bhajan period at his group interviews in the rooms. The only thing one can be sure of is that he will never follow the same routine of action twice in succession.
Here the author makes an interesting reference to Sai Baba's pet elephant, Sai Gita, who passed away in 2007.
When the second bhajan of the day begins in the evening, Baba is usually still conducting interviews. Then after some time, he comes out and walks down a path to feed his young elephant, Sai Gita. As soon as the elephant sees him, she approaches majestically, holding high in her trunk a garland of flowers made by some ladies of the ashram. When the two meet, Sai Gita places the garland over Baba's head and bows, bending her right foreleg. Baba pats her and feeds her with fruit from a basket which her young mahout has brought. After a while, he leaves her with the basket and walks around to have a word with people sitting by the side of the path. But all the while, Sai Gita keeps her eye on him and turns so that her head is always facing towards her beloved Lord. When her supper of fruit is finished, she carries the empty basket back towards her stable. But if Baba calls to her to stop or to come to him, she obeys immediately. This pet elephant was presented to him when she was quite a baby by some devotees of the south. She has become a much loved feature of the ashram, trumpeting a loud salute when she spots Baba's red robe in the distance, or somehow senses his presence without seeing him.
The author observed that Swami's daily routine does not end with this. There is more.
After the evening bhajan and its beautiful closing ritual of aarti with camphor light and a hymn of worship, the crowd pours from the hall and from under the trees to the front of the building. Here all stand and wait for the evening darshan. Soon the little red figure with the great dome of black hair is seen on the lighted balcony. There is a deep hush. His lips move silently. His hand moves in a gesture of upliftment. Something more subtle than the air around seems also to move upward, gripping the heart and lifting it until the eyes are moist. Then we go to our suppers. But Baba spends most of the evening seeing more people, ashram officials with administration problems, and visitors with urgent personal problems.
Even in those days, the author notes that Puttaparthi used to get quite crowded, but even in that crowd was a unifying sentiment.
One of the most interesting features of life at the ashram is the people there, residents and visitors. A whole volume could be written on this subject alone. They come for such a variety of reasons. Some travel hundreds of miles as people went to the Delphic Oracle of old to peep into the future. Others come for business reasons, to ask if they should sell a shop, start a factory, tender for a contract, or look for a new job. Many come with serious health problems. Some arrive as representatives of Sai Baba groups in other areas to invite Swami to grace some function with his presence. A few are there to ask him to their homes, perhaps to perform a marriage, or name a child, or bless a new house, or simply for the indescribable joy of his company. Baba would need to be multi-bodied to satisfy all such requests. An important point to note about Sai Baba in both this body and the former one is that he does not in the least resent being treated as a fortune teller. A soothsayer, a psychic investigator, a business advisor, or a universal physician. He regards all who come as his children. Some want a broken toy mended, some have an earache, some just want a word of encouragement from the eternal parent. He tries to satisfy all at their own level, and by his powerful spiritual force to raise that level towards the superhuman race that man must eventually become. He sheds his blessings on all, but of course, their own limitations condition what they receive. If their present needs are for bodily health or material prosperity, that's what they get. Those in the higher grades, the jnanis, are much fewer in numbers than the others, but they do exist. With great joy, with a rare feeling of upliftment, I have met some of those, not only living a life of renunciation at the ashram, but also as householders. Another important point I learned was that when Baba appears to be hard on some of his followers, it is really a great compliment to them and indeed a blessing in disguise. It does not mean, as some may think, that these disciples have lost his love and been cast into the outer darkness. On the contrary, it means that Baba has high regard for those he is putting through the grinding mill. He is training them for greater progress in the school of the spirit. Sometimes in this way, and apparently for this purpose, he seems to test people to the highest level of their endurance. Even after their mettle has been tested and proved, he will, if necessary, put them through what he calls a polishing process. This may bring a great deal of mental anguish until deeper understanding dawns on the initiate. Thus, many of Baba's long-term disciples helped us to perceive the hidden dimensions of the Master's mission and purpose. They made clearer to us the beneath-the-surface meaning of many of his actions and words.
And slowly, only a few days were left before the couple was supposed to leave the ashram. In a final interview that Swami gave them, Mr. Murfitt recounts a few experiences.
Present at the final interview were Mr. and Mrs. K.R.K. Bhatt, in whose car we were being given a lift to Bangalore. Mr. Bhatt is a retired divisional manager of the Life Insurance Corporation of India. He suffered a serious heart attack just before his retirement and is now living most of the time at Prashanthi Nilayam, being kept alive, as he says himself, by the grace of Sai Baba. He and his wife were returning to Bangalore for a while to arrange some personal matters. But for a few days, Mr. Bhatt had been suffering pain on his left side in the heart region, and as doctors had previously forbidden him to drive the car, I volunteered to drive it for him. Later, Iris and I were called for a personal interview by Swami. Immediately, Swami was alone with us. He dropped all joking and teasing and spoke very seriously in a voice of deep affection. He was like a mother seeing her children off to boarding school, except that he seemed to be the essence of all the mothers the earth has ever known. The stream of affection that flowed from him was a river carrying one off into an ocean of love. In that ocean, one's physical body seemed to vanish, and all the hard lumps of separate self, of anxiety and worry and deep-lying fear were melted away. For those exalted moments, one touched the edges of the infinite and felt the ineffable joy of it. Many of the Baba devotees have told me about their own personal experience of this deepest of the mysteries and miracles, where a man touches and momentarily becomes one with the divine in man. But like me, none has been able to describe it adequately, for it is far beyond the reach of words. After giving us personal advice regarding our work and health and lives, and assuring us that there is never any need for fear or worry because He is always with us in our hearts, he waved his hand, this time in large vertical circles like a turning wheel. When his hand stopped, it held a little silver container, an inch in height and over an inch in diameter. As he opened the lid, a fragrant perfume pervaded the room. The container was full of light grey vibhuti, which proved to be as fragrant to the tongue as it was to the nose. Giving it to us, he said to take a little every day. It would bring great benefits and blessings to both body and soul. The last persons to whom he spoke privately were Mr. and Mrs. Bhatt. As it was an auspicious day for the devotees of Lord Subramanyam, their chief household god, Mrs. Bhatt had brought a small bouquet of flowers and tulsi leaves. These she placed at the feet of Sai Baba, who has become to her the embodiment of Lord Subramanyam. The reason for this will be fully understood from her miraculous experience related in the next chapter. Baba put a few of the flowers in her hair, then telling us all to wait for some prasad, gifts of packets of vibhuti, we thought, he went upstairs to his dining room, which is directly above the interview room. He took, we presume, the remainder of the bouquet with him, and we all stood waiting. Iris and I were standing by Mr. Bhatt on his left. Mrs. Bhatt was to his right, while the rest of the group was on the other side of the room. As we exchanged a word or two with Mr. Bhatt, a very tall man, Iris saw what she took to be flakes of dried paint falling from the ceiling. I did not notice these flakes until they were perhaps a foot and a half above Mr. Bhatt's left shoulder on which they came to rest. Then I observed that the flakes were actually tulsi leaves and a few flower petals. I could see from Mr. Bhatt's face that he immediately felt something miraculous in this event, but I looked for a natural explanation. It seemed, however, impossible to find one. The leaves and petals could not possibly have fallen off anything in the room, which was unfurnished except for one chair and a cupboard in a corner some distance from where we stood, and the walls of the room were bare. Moreover, the leaves and petals could not have fallen from Mrs. Bhatt's head, because she is a very short woman and was anyway on the right side of her husband, whereas they fell from a high level on his left side. Furthermore, there had been no leaves in her hair, only flowers, and these were still in place after the incident. Nor could the bits of foliage have blown in through the window, first, because there was no breeze, the air being quite still, second, because there are no tulsi bushes anywhere near the window, and third, because if they had come in the window, they would not have been at the height where first seen by my wife or even by me. I could think of absolutely no place from which they could have arrived by the normal forces of nature. But after the touch of the leaves from above, Mr. Bhatt needed nothing more. He felt so well that he drove the car most of the way to Bangalore himself, letting me take the wheel for only a few miles. There was no return of Bhatt's heart pain. It seemed to have been borne away by the healing beam, which as its signature brought the miraculous fall of leaves and petals.
So many close encounters with Bhagwan in so little time. Mr. Murfitt was indeed blessed. We hope you enjoyed today's session. More when we get together again. Meanwhile, all the best and Jai Sai Ram. You have been listening to a presentation of excerpts from Mr. Howard Murfitt's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. This book has been published in 1971 by Frederick Miller Limited in London.